Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Wednesday, December 16th, 2015. And with me today, I have Kelly Goumont. It's great to have you here, Kelly.
Sorry, I was thinking about something else.
I think you were thinking about something else long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I totally am. That's very, very true.
Yeah, and it should come as no surprise to people that we're getting inappropriately excited. About this weekend's Star Wars: The Force Awakens release.
Nothing but Star Wars. Sorry,
you know me so well, John Martellaro. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. December 16th already. Oh my god. Oh my god.
I know.
Gotta rush.
I know, because you only have a couple days to finish everything up before you go stand in line to see Star Wars.
That's right.
Yeah.
Before Star Wars.
Before Star Wars.
There's some other thing that's supposedly happening later this month. I don't know. But Star Wars.
I know Star Wars is on my calendar, and that's it. Anyhow. Yeah. So one thing that I wanted to talk about today, which is kind of cool. Actually, what I want to do is give everyone a little bit of a heads up. Our sponsor this week is Aurora HDR. And it's actually really, really cool. And I'm pretty excited to be talking about them. But you're going to have to wait for me to talk about them. Because first, what I want to talk about is the iPad and 3D Touch. And where the iPad interface may be going. And what's bringing this up right now is this report that's out there talking about how Apple is looking at how they're going to incorporate 3D touch, or that, you know, the pressure sensitive touch like we have on the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, how that's going to fit in with the iPad Pro. And John, you have a little bit of insight here, and Kelly, I'm betting you may have some ideas. And I thought this would be a really great thing for us to dive into.
Okay. Well,
for starters, I think this is a part of Apple's attempt to breathe new technical life into the iPad, to broaden its appeal, to make sure that it doesn't fall technically behind the iPhone, but even more so on the iPad Pro, to give it the Pro level capabilities. And my theory is that we're seeing the edges of that with split screen and picture in picture. Now, the iPad Air 2 can do split screen and picture in picture, but I think it's part of a process that Apple's going through to up the level of usability and user interface and technology on the iPads. Because for a long time, iOS kind of drifted. You know, the iPad was just a giant iPhone, and you tapped and browsed. And so, especially with the iPad Pro being out, I think there's motivation by Apple, renewed motivation to exploit all the technology that they can to create potential and appeal to professionals.
But see, here's the thing about that is that I feel like if they were going to bring 3D touch to something, and keep in mind that when I talk about 3D touch, what I'm talking about is fingers on a screen, not necessarily a stylus. If I'm just looking at easier ways to manipulate stuff on my screen and interact with it using my thumb or an index finger or whatever, when I think of that, I think of the advantage being on the smaller iPads. I feel like Force Touch and an iPad, 3D Touch and an iPad Mini is an unstoppable combination.
Well, the problem, Kelly, is that a lot of people were finding that their iPhone 6S Plus with its big screen is an adequate substitute to the iPad.
Right.
And if the iPad falls behind technically, that just puts another nail in the coffin of the iPad.
Right, and I get that, but what I have observed, because I'm not an iPad Pro owner, but most of the people that I see getting the most mileage out of the Pro are people who aren't touching them. And that sounds weird, but it's
it
people who have a keyboard hooked up and are using it because it's an attractive alternative to having a MacBook that they haul around, or people who are using it primarily as a drawing tool because it's cheaper than a gigantic Wacom tablet, and on and on. So for a lot of people, it seems like the interaction with it isn't going to gain much by getting 3D Touch. So the 6S Plus with 3D Touch is amazing. I feel like the iPad Mini, something in the size neighborhood of the iPad Air 2, those are the places where 3D Touch is going to be, I think, revolutionary, is when you get that slightly bigger screen, but not the mega screen, because it seems like there's some sweet spot where people sort of end up using their fingers on the screen a little less because the screen is a little bigger. And at least in, like I said, in what I have observed, there may be other people who are like, I know loads of people who have iPad Pros and no peripherals at all, and they are totally happy to be laying hands upon the screen all the live long day. Well, I just don't know any of those people. My experience is the opposite.
I take the opposite point of view. When you're typing with the keyboard,
John.
there are things you have to do. You type characters with the keyboard, but in order to do editing, the magnifying glass, you have to reach out and touch the screen. And that creates a kind of mixed mode environment that is surprising to some people, and it may be irritating to others, to the extent that you can get more done with the touch and you can be more productive and have a more enjoyable experience by the things you can do by touching, that takes that oxymoron away, so to speak.
I think
it's useful.
Yeah, like I said, it's just my observation is that people who are using peripherals aren't going to gain much from this. So if they were to rev the iPad Mini, now that it's got the Air 2 innards in that compact little package, if that were then to get a new generation that had the 3D Touch on it, I think, honestly, that's the sweet spot for it, and that's the thing that would really make the huge difference. Because I know Touch ID, when it came to the iPad, was a huge thing. And I know that when I pick my iPad up to this day, because I got my iPad and my iPhone 5S about the same time. And to this day, every once in a while, I pick up my iPad and I know it's a totally different size and it's in a different case and all that kind of stuff. I still hold my thumb on the button and wait. And it always takes a split second to figure out, like, yeah, this one doesn't do that.
Yeah. Now, when I look at 3D Touch on the iPad, especially like on the iPad Pro, I don't want it to be the peek, pop, poke kind of stuff, which now suddenly sounds like I'm programming an Apple Basic. And if you don't get what I just said, go ahead, get off my lawn. I don't want my 3D Touch experience on the iPad to be the same as it is on my iPhone. And that's because it's a different interface. I have a different way of using the device, a different way of interacting with it. And if that's all it really is the same thing that I have on my iPhone, then I don't see that as a truly compelling feature addition for the iPad line. Apple needs to come up with some really interesting way that we're using the whole 3D Touch thing on the tablets.
Funny you should say that, Jeff, because I saw an article the other day that was very good by Jen Dawson at Tech.Pinions. It was December 3rd, by the way. And he said the case for Pad OS, you know, we have iOS, and then we had Watch OS, and then we had TV OS. What Jen is arguing, it's a guy, that we have Pad OS, and that Apple tailor a new version of iOS for these larger screens that exploits its capabilities, just as you hinted at a second ago. And so going back full circle to my original comments and what we've talked about just now, what with new ways of using 3D Touch and new capabilities with the A9 and A10 processor coming and a new operating system that can exploit the large screen, it looks like Apple might be well on its way to a Pad Pro OS that separates itself from the simplicity of the iPhone and the iPad Mini.
You know, I can see that happening on one hand, because there's so much more you could do with an iPad if it wasn't shackled to the iPhone's interface. On the other hand, I could see Apple artificially limiting what we can do to keep from splintering their interfaces too much. Because as it stands right now, we have, well, now we have three interfaces. We have our desktop interface, which is also our laptop interface. We have our mobile interface, which is on the iPad and iPhone. And then we have our wrist-top interface on the Apple Watch. And
clearly what the world needs is another one.
Right. And
well, that may be true, Kelly. It may be true.
Now, if anyone can come up with a way to split the operating systems yet again, but keep it so that it doesn't really feel like we just have this jumble of interfaces, it would be Apple. However, I do worry, because if we're fragmenting the operating system, fragment's not the right word. If we are tailoring interfaces for all these different devices, at what point does it turn into the same mess that Android developers have to deal with, where they have to sort out all these different interfaces? And yes, I know Apple has the dynamic sizing stuff built into iOS, but I mean, is that going to be enough?
Well, Android's fragmentation is on a single platform. So you have all these different versions of Android for this, say, the same Samsung phones. But this is fragmentation across distinctly different platforms. So I'm not too worried about that.
But you could argue the same thing about Android, because all of those apps need to be able to run on everything from a 4-inch phone to a 10-inch tablet. And each of those is a different thing. And the problem that you end up with is trying to find the sweet spot, particularly in the United States, of what carriers have allowed as updates. So if you draw a line, like, I'm not going to design it to run on anything older than this particular operating system, how many people are you excluding by doing that? And you have to kind of play that roulette game. And it sucks, because I know some Android developers who do it. And there's a reason a lot of bourbon is sold to Android developers.
All iPad apps and iPhone apps will continue to run on the iPad Pro.
But the thing is, there's so much...
There'll be augmented apps for the Pro.
But there's so much fragmentation already. And I'm sure that if there are developers listening right now, listening to people talk about how it's not really all that fragmented, they are howling right now in disagreement. Because even just screenshots for the App Store... the App Camp for Girls app, when we put that together and had to make sure that it was ready for distribution, just getting the dimensions right, the basic stuff like how it should look on all the screens that it supports and what the screenshots need to look like for each version of the App Store, was a lot of work. And that's for what we have right now, which people are saying isn't very fragmented. And it's true. You can make an iPad-only app. You can make an iPhone-only app. You can make a watch app, and you can probably make something that's tvOS specific, even though it may not be nearly as useful if you don't have something else to hook it up to. So there's already a lot of that happening, and I would be gravely concerned about dropping another interface in the mix. And I know that the auto layout and some of those tools make some of that easier, but that doesn't change the fact that handling the new features that would come from something like 3D Touch are very different. And I feel like this is on Apple, but it's more of an App Store issue. Like, we talked about the app thinning and stuff that they're already doing. If you have updates, you know, because, like, for example, for this last couple of months, I've been getting nothing but iPad, you know, updated for iPad Pro. Why do I need to update my phone to the latest version of your app to support something that I don't own? Just like we had the wave earlier this year of watch apps that do the same thing. I don't need an update to make it work better with my imaginary watch, because nothing is compatible with my imaginary watch because it's imaginary.
Well, you have an imaginary watch. You could make it imaginarily compatible with everything in the world.
Without an update. That's where I'm trying to get to. So, like, and maybe it's just because... the lifestyle to which I have become accustomed does not mean that I get to buy everything that comes out. And so maybe just to me, it's sort of aggravating to have to go put 56 updates on my phone when all 56 of them are for something that I don't have. And it's just a reminder every time that you don't have one of these. And I kind of wish I did. And that's a bummer.
Apple will figure it out.
Yeah. Well, my
guess is if anyone can sort this out in a way that makes sense and is reasonable, it's going to be Apple. And so we don't know what's really happening. And my guess is that Apple still has a lot to work out before we really do see 3D touch on tablets.
Sure. I think it's a manufacturing issue at this point, honestly.
I think
that's the issue. Once we get to, what does Tib call it on the call when you can finally walk in a store and buy the thing? Demand supply balance?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Is that what it is? Supply demand balance? Demand supply balance? I don't remember what he called it, but something like that. When we reach that point, at that point, you know, the manufacturing, at least on the S screens, the 6S and the 6S Plus screens, should be at a point where, like, they've kind of dialed that in and the, you know, the error rate is really low and all that kind of stuff. And so hopefully, then at that point, they could start making the larger ones so that it can come to any other devices besides the
iPhone. That's a good point, Kelly. Everything's easier on a 5-inch screen than it is on a 10-inch screen. So
precisely,
the technology naturally appears first on the phones.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, and Apple has done this many times where they introduce a feature on the iPhone and then later it comes to the iPad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we need to move on. So we're going to.
Okay.
And we're going to move on to our sponsor. And our sponsor this week is MacFun's Aurora HDR. And the past couple of days, I've talked about how awesome this is as a tool on your Mac to enhance your HDR images that you're taking. And I feel like I haven't done this app justice because it is so much more than that. And you don't need to take HDR photos to take advantage of what this app can do.
Really?
Yeah, to the point where I think they should rename it to Aurora HDR and other really awesome things you can do with your photos app. So here's an example. Let's say you take a shot with your iPhone. And you like how it looks, but you think, I could really make this more dramatic if I just had the right tools. And you just don't feel like sitting down with Photoshop and working through everything that Photoshop has to try and make this happen. You want something that makes it easy. Okay, take that single image and put it in Aurora HDR, and it can look at your image and then just automatically enhance it and make it much more dramatic. And it comes with all of these presets, like gobs of presets. So you can enhance images in different ways to get different effects and moods and feelings out of your shots. And then you can overlay like textures and take multiple versions of an image and put them together and paint out with opacity, so like pressure-sensitive styluses, like a Wacom tablet. So you can really bring out a piece from one image in another, and then you can take all these presets and you can go in and really fine-tune them and create just the image you're looking for, and you can do all this on a single image. And when I realized I could do that, I was like, okay. This suddenly became like the single coolest image editing tool for my Mac, because now all these things that I've spent a really long time in Photoshop doing to make an image more dramatic, mm-hmm. I can do with a couple mouse clicks in Aurora HDR. It's really awesome. So you can get this and you know, make your images, and then you can share them out to social networking services and they just released an update. So you can use this in conjunction with Apple's Photos app. So there's already a link in that goes to Photoshop and to Lightroom, but now it works with photo extensions as of like this morning. So you can hook this into the Photos app and do all kinds of crazy image enhancements.
Dang.
Yeah, it's like fracking awesome. And for me to get that excited about a photo imaging or image editing and enhancement app is saying quite a bit, because I've played with a lot of them over the years and typically end up just going back to Photoshop. Okay, so here's the deal. You can get a hold of Aurora HDR.
I'm like, fine, tell me how I can get my hands on it. Okay.
Okay, Kelly, here's how you can get your hands on it. What you need to do is go to aurorahdr.com/TDO. So that's AuroraHDR.com/TDO. And when you go to that link, you're going to be able to pick up Aurora HDR for $99.99. So $100. And what that's going to get you is a package that actually costs $260, but you get it for $100. So it includes the Aurora HDR app with its plugins to go back to Photoshop and Lightroom, and hopefully the update will be out very quickly for everyone to be able to hook it back into Photos. So don't worry, it's happening soon. Plus, you get a month of free training from the photo editing training people, Arcanum.
Oh.
Then you get a bunch of photo textures, a whole bonus pack. You get an HDR tutorial from Trey Ratcliffe, who is a very well-known photographer who specializes in HDR stuff. Plus, you get an ebook on using Aurora HDR that's written by Jeff Carlson.
I love Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff is an awesome guy. He's an excellent author. He's written tons of books, and he's an amazing photographer.
And a great explainer.
And a great explainer. And so you get all of that thrown in together.
Wow.
$99. And $260 worth of stuff. Now, don't procrastinate, because the deal is running through the end of the month, so through December 31st. And so go take advantage of it. Anyhow, aurorahdr.com/TDO. Go pick up your copy of the app for your Mac right away. And if I'm excited about it, that means you're going to be excited too. Okay.
Think of all the awesome stuff you can do when you get home from Star Wars with all the pictures that you took in line.
I know. It's going to be...
But not in the theater.
No, not in the theater. I said in the line.
No, in the line. No.
That's yeah. No. Well, why would you take pictures in the theater? You want to take pictures in line, because I remember lining up for the old movies, not the original movies, but when the prequels came out, I waited in line a lot, and I waited in line a lot with lightsabers. And every single time there was a random little kid who came up and wanted to play lightsabers with me, and it was super awesome every single time. And I had a lot of fun playing lightsabers with people in line at Star Wars. And it would really be awesome if I had pictures of any of that, because then, particularly now, like, because I can take such a better picture with the camera in my phone than I could in the olden days, it would really be great to be able to bring those home and do something really awesome with them. I'm already, like, formulating how I'm going to make the pictures I took of the Christmas lights on my house this year look really awesome using Aurora HDR.
You're going to be able to do some cool stuff.
Awesome.
Okay. Hey, we are out of time. But
okay,
I'm going to take us over just a couple minutes.
I can do it in 1 minute, Jeff.
Okay, so here's John giving us the most awesome wrap up and follow up to Netflix's streaming video changes that they're making that we discussed yesterday. Take it away, John.
Okay, so when I got out of bed yesterday morning, I read Jeff Gamma's wonderful article, Netflix Tackles Bandwidth Caps with More Efficient Video Encoding System. And at first blush, what I thought was that Netflix had invented its own video compression algorithm to replace H.264. And that launched us into a discussion yesterday on TDO about how I thought that would be a very bad idea. But you and Brian were suggesting that it was perhaps something different, or Netflix really didn't know what they were doing. So I did some research, and what I found out yesterday was that Netflix is still using the tried and true H.264 compression algorithm. They haven't tried to invent anything new. What they're doing is they're going back and they're adjusting the bit rate for their content. Instead of being fixed across the resolution spectrum, they're varying the bitrate based on the nature of the content. So for non-stressful videos like cartoons that have not much motion and solid colors that aren't moving real fast, they can lower the bitrate on the average, they can achieve a savings across the board in this kind of content. And so everything's cool, and what Netflix is doing is very smart. And so I wrote a follow-up article on it yesterday in the afternoon called How Netflix is Delivering Better Video with Less Bandwidth that explains everything.
So it turns out we can all be happy.
Yes, yes.
Because lower bandwidth usage, still the same high video quality, and no fracturing of the video codec standards.
Exactly.
Awesome. It's great all around.
So it's great all around. All right.
And I just want to jump in really quick. I want to applaud Netflix for having worked this out, because anything that involves video encoding, in my experience, is a big brain problem. Like, you have to get some really smart people who have the patience to wade through these kinds of standards and wade through the constraints and the requirements. You know, you have to do this, but you can't do any of this. And figuring out what the sweet spot is between those, and then being able to engineer something to put it out on Netflix's scale. And to me, that is super, super duper impressive. Like, even before you get to the point that you know, if I had a data cap, this would be saving me some money or, you know, whatever, anything like that. Like, I don't even care about that part. It's the fact that the engineering exists is something that I feel like I have to marvel at, because that's a really tough nut to crack, regardless of who you are. So bravo to Netflix for having been able to find a way to make this possible.
Indeed.
All right. And on that happy note, we are wrapping up.
Okay.
Kelly, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff. May the force be with you.
May the force be with you. John, thank you for being here.
Live long and prosper.
Infinite
peace
diversity.
And long life.
Infinite combinations. And MacFun and Aurora HDR, thank you for being our sponsor this week. Head over to their website, aurorahdr.com/TDO, and pick up their whole awesome Aurora HDR package for $99. It's a killer deal. Listeners, thank you for joining us. We're going to see everyone again tomorrow.